Welcome to Law Talk, the podcast from TPP Law, the public services specialist. Coming up, the latest news, views and features on outsourcing and partnerships in public services.
A very warm welcome from me, Mark Johnson.
And from me, Gemma Brown.
In this new podcast from TPP Law, we aim to bring you up to date with topics and issues affecting outsourcing and partnerships.
Public service mutuals, we ask, are they the new way to deliver high quality public services at a cost effective price?
In Industry View, we'll bring you insights and analysis from an industry specialist at the coalface. This week we speak to Rania Leontaridi, who's Director of the Mutuals Programme at the Cabinet Office.
And we finish with a news roundup, a quick canter through the latest topics affecting public services.
You're listening to Law Talk, the legal news podcast from TPP Law, the public services specialist.
So first up, our main feature. There is a new phenomenon sweeping through public services, and that is the public service mutual. It's a new mechanism for delivering high-quality, tailored public services. It differs from keeping services in-house in the public sector or outsourcing to private sector companies. And the government wants to see more of them. Cabinet Office Minister Francis Maude said in 2011 that he wanted to see 1 million public servants working in mutuals by 2015. The government has set up a special programme of financial and technical assistance, the Mutual Support Programme, run by the Cabinet Office. And later in this edition of Law Talk, we'll be talking to the director of that programme.
Public service mutuals are defined by government as an organisation which has left the public sector, a process known as spinning out, but which continues to deliver public services. Mutuals are organisations in which employee control plays a significant role in their operation. There are three key ingredients to the public service mutual: a service transitioning out of the public sector, a continuing role in delivering public services, perhaps under contract to the former host body, and employees have a significant say in the running of the organisation, for example by owning shares in the enterprise. But the concept is a broad church, ranging from non-profit distributing social enterprises to joint ventures between staff teams and large private sector companies.
There are now lots of examples of successful public service mutuals delivering a wide range of public services. We have MyCSP, which runs the Civil Service Pension Scheme, Greenwich Leisure, a successful enterprise running council leisure centres, and Central Surrey Healthcare, to name just three. Launching a public service mutual is not a soft option, though. In our experience, there are some key issues which need to be addressed.
Firstly, what is the nature of the contract awarded to the public service mutual? Is there a long-term income stream on which to build a business? Aside from the contract with the host authority, will there be opportunities to win contracts and new business outside of the current territory? Of course, bidding for these opportunities requires a particular skill set and resources to put bids together.
Secondly, public procurement rules. How will the host authority treat the award of the contract to the new spin-out? Will it need to be exposed to competition? There are various strategies which authorities have used to address the public procurement issue. These range from advertising the opportunity in a trade journal to setting up a so-called TECL company as a stepping stone to full autonomy for the spin-out. A TECL company, named after a European court case in which the issue arose, is essentially a company owned and controlled by the host authority, which does the majority of its business with that authority. If these criteria are satisfied, then the award of a contract to that body does not need to comply with the European procurement rules. So no need to advertise in ODU, use predefined selection criteria, and so on. Of course, a TECL company may not be the solution if the idea is to give the service managers more autonomy. A company wholly controlled by the council may not be in any better position to achieve service transformation than an in-house department.
Thirdly, there is the issue of TUPE and pension rights. TUPE stands for Transfer of Undertakings, Protection of Employment Regulations. The effect of these regulations is to ensure that where a service is contracted out, for example to a public service mutual, the staff involved in delivering that service will transfer to the new service provider with their terms and conditions intact. For the new spin-out business, this means that they will inherit the existing payroll costs. They may find it very difficult to change the terms and conditions to achieve cost savings. Equally, the Cabinet Office Statement of Practice on Outsourcing requires that staff transferring out of the public sector should be offered a pension which is broadly comparable with their current pension. With public sector contribution rates running at 14% for local authorities and 24% in the NHS, this represents a very significant cost for the new startup. In local authorities, it may be possible to set up a so-called admission agreement, whereby the new mutual becomes a participating employer in the local government pension scheme. However, the mutual needs to be aware that the scheme administrator may ask for increased employer contributions at any stage, which it may not be able to pass on to its customers in the contracts. There is usually also some negotiation around the risks of any historic underfunding of the scheme at the point when the service transfers.
Fourthly, is this a sustainable enterprise? For the enterprise to be sustainable, there needs to be a situation where the income received from contracts is enough to cover the costs of running the enterprise plus a surplus, ideally at least 5%, but often considerably more than this if any private sector investors are involved and are looking for a return on their money. It is this surplus which the management can decide how to spend. They may choose to reinvest it in the service, or in some cases they might decide to pay some of it to employees or other stakeholders as a dividend. The new enterprise will also need working capital, that is surplus cash to meet its costs in the early stages, including paying salaries, paying the rent, often before any income is received from its customer contracts. Working capital can come from a variety of sources. It could be a dowry or advance payment from the host authority, or alternatively, investment could be raised from loans or shares issued to employees, stakeholders, or third-party investors.
All of this begs the question, if the overriding concern at present is to find cost savings, how will the new enterprise do this? Usually, the biggest area of expense is the payroll bill. In our experience, this can run at between 70 to 85% of the total costs. This is probably not sustainable. Cost savings may come from a variety of sources: restructuring the workforce to reduce headcount, introducing new technology to improve efficiency, but of course this technology has to be financed somehow, introducing leaner processes and working practices, and reducing corporate overheads on back-office services like HR, payroll, procurement, and accounting services. It may be that the mutual can achieve a better deal by purchasing these services outside the authority.
A key point to bear in mind is that simply transferring a service across into a standalone company will not, of itself, achieve the transformation needed to make the service viable in the long run. There will need to be a transition plan and a commitment to serious service redesign to make the enterprise sustainable. I suppose then the final key question is, what is it that you can do differently operating as a public service mutual that you can't do now? And the answer to that question from the spin-outs that we've worked with is many and varied. Some will say that operating as an autonomous mutual gives them headspace for innovation, freedom from corporate overheads and bureaucracy, and in some cases, perhaps the ability to raise finance off the public sector host's balance sheet.
Despite the challenges, there are now many good examples of public service mutuals. These brave pioneers are the disruptive innovators that government hopes will shake up public service markets, increasing the diversity of suppliers and providing greater choice for service users. It will be interesting to see how these fledgling enterprises develop. For example, will we see smaller local enterprises consolidating into groups to achieve economies of scale and raise finance on the back of a stronger balance sheet? Will some of these local enterprises be acquired by larger private sector players, anxious to secure market share?
With 65 mutuals now up and running, it is clear that the initiative has reached a tipping point. If you'd like more information about starting a public service mutual, visit our website at tpplaw.co.uk/kickstart-a-mutual. That's all one word, lowercase.
Stay tuned for Industry View. This week, Mark talks to the head of the Cabinet Office Mutuals Programme.
You're listening to Law Talk, the legal news podcast from TPP Law, the public services specialist.
Rania Leontaridi, thank you for joining us on Law Talk. Can you tell us about your role here at the Cabinet Office?
I am the Director of the Mutuals Programme and also the Head of the New Commercial Models. So what that means is I'm responsible for expanding the number of mutuals across the wider public sector, but also we are looking to increase the number of different models of delivery for public services across the whole economy.
And can you tell us about the Mutual Support Programme?
Yes, the Mutual Support Programme was announced back in 2010 by the Minister for Cabinet Office, Francis Maude. It is £10 million and it is aimed to support fledgling mutuals who would like to set up and run their own independent businesses. They have the ability to apply to us, they get triaged and they get access to business advice, which we procure on their behalf while they receive the services. We have supported to date about 26 of them. We spent more around £1 million in the last year since it was set up. It was set up in February 2012. The key deliverables are stored on our website at the Mutual Information Service, so other organisations can use them over and over again.
And how do mutuals fit into the wider context of public service reform?
The Open Public Services White Paper highlighted the need for diversifying the provision of public services to increase the efficiency of public service provision and to deliver better outcomes for the users of public services. Public service mutuals are a new form of provision. They are set up by previous public sector employees. As I said, they're independent organisations. They're based on the entrepreneurial nature of the public sector employees, and to date have been delivering more than almost £1 billion worth of services in various sectors, starting from health to school services, social care, and more recently we've seen other interests from other areas such as libraries, probation, trusts, fire services.
Cabinet Office uses a specific term, the public service mutual, to describe organisations that spin out from within the public sector. What would you say are the key characteristics of a public service mutual in your view?
So the public service mutual, the way we describe it, is an organisation that has spun out of the public sector. It's independent and continues to deliver public services for the larger part of their contract. One of the key characteristics is the role that employees play in the running of those services. They are either owned by employees or have a very strong employee engagement. So employee engagement and ownership is one of the fundamental drivers for public service mutuals.
What kind of public services are best suited to becoming mutuals, would you say?
This is a very interesting question because a long time ago when this agenda first started, we took a wider look across the whole of the public sector and we found very few services that cannot be mutualised, and potentially maybe only the army. What we have come to realise is that there is not a specific service that is suited to mutualisation, but any kind of public service could potentially be mutualised. As I said before, what is important is the drive of the employees, is the innovation that these mutuals display in the delivery of public services, and the engagement of the employees that drives some of the growth and innovation in the way they provide their services.
What's been the appetite of public sector teams so far to pursue the idea of spinning out into a mutual?
It's actually surprisingly very, very high, and it's becoming much higher. And I say surprisingly because when we first started, it was an unknown to them, and they had some potential idea and interest in pursuing the model of public service mutual, but they didn't know where to start. So we've seen a significant amount of interest, and interest rising as the months rolled by. The Mutual Support Programme have supported that. We've seen a lot of local authorities engaging with us. We have more than 70, 80 local authorities at last count connecting with us, talking to us, having various sort of meeting or round tables or conversations. We see employees out on the ground calling our own line and visiting our website in large numbers. So we have more than 1,600 hits on the website weekly, and that keeps increasing. We We get interest from across the world, not only here. So we have a continuous interest of employees interesting in finding out how to create public service mutuals in countries anywhere from Korea to Sweden to New Zealand and Denmark. Employees remain, as I said, quite interested. The majority of the large swathes of employees are in areas of local government.
What kind of barriers and issues have been encountered in developing mutuals up to now?
That is interesting. The first thing is employees, as I said in the beginning, didn't know where to start. They didn't have the basic advice, how to form a company, how to spin out, how to take a lot of the sort of the rest of their colleagues outside of the public sector. So any kind of difficulties that a normal person will face in trying to set up an independent small business or an independent company, because in some cases mutuals are not small, they're large businesses. But in addition to that, what they did face is an understanding of what is their capacity. So the Mutual Support Programme, the Mutual Information Service, helped in that respect. We've seen them raising quite a lot of interesting questions around finance, how can they finance the services, how they can diversify and grow. And these are some issues that we'll be looking more into the future. We're about to launch some work with Big Society Capital and the Boston Consulting Group to figure out more about what are the needs of the sector, how far they grow, what are the finance needs of the sector. So that's one of the, I wouldn't say barriers, but issue for us to investigate further. The second issue that quite a lot of the public sector employees and others there discuss is procurement. And we have seen in areas, we have seen quite often local commissioners of public services misinterpreting in cases the procurement law. We've made quite a large strides in putting out information of how to interpret procurement regulations, but also we're negotiating closely with the EU for potential exclusion mutuals for the first 3 years of their existence from procurement law.
How are public services being transformed by moving into a mutual format? And do you have any good examples?
Yes. As I said before, going around to the various local authorities, we hear now quite a lot of public service mutuals telling us back the kind of stuff that they do and explaining to us how they diversify their services, where they find the biggest changes, both in terms of innovation but also in terms of delivery of service. So we know, for example, that one of our mutuals has managed to grow its business by about 262%, and that's not a mistake. A lot of people said to me, so it's not 26.2. I said, no, it is 262%. So this is Social Adventures in Salford, who increased their annual turnover by that amount. Another example is employees of the Hull City Healthcare Partnership found significant savings of about £600,000 and boosted their customer satisfaction. One thing I would say, and I say it quite often, is what we see in some of the mutuals that span out the health sector is quite significant customer satisfaction scores unseen before in community healthcare provision. One of our other mutuals, Centerside Health, has managed to raise their productivity in the stroke ward by about 41%. We have seen their absenteeism rates being significantly reduced, anything from 22 days down to 10. And as we all know, absenteeism is quite a big problem in sort of for the whole economy. And we've seen quite a lot of significant examples of innovation across some of the IT services that those mutuals use, or the digital delivery of services. So, for example, for one of our mutuals, delivery of remote social care services are done through iPads.
How do you see the market developing in the future?
Well, I think what we will see is an even larger number of public service mutuals spinning out. We already gone between 2010 and now increased the number of public service mutuals from 9 to 67 live. We have seen them increasing from about 4 sectors that they were active back then to 12. And we continue to get new examples every other week of a new public service mutual. Not long ago, one of the fledgling mutuals that went through the mutual support program was York Library, one of the first libraries to apply for mutualization, and we believe that we will see more of them that will follow.
And what is the Cabinet Office doing to encourage the development of mutuals?
We do three things. The first thing is we look across the policy barriers or the policy changes, anything from taxation, procurement, as I said before, finance issues, and we try to identify ways of solving problems or indeed creating new solutions that will help some of our mutuals take off. The second thing that we do is we try to communicate. We try to communicate their successes. We have a very, as a team, we have a very active ethos around communication. We do quite a lot of conferences, roundtables. We move around the country quite often. We have a series of roadshows, as we call them, that we hold in John Lewis stores across the country. Our next one is coming up on the 13th of March up in Exeter. And we try to bust myths, inform and explain what is possible and what others have done. Our programme of Mutuals Ambassadors is another way of communicating not only the successes but also the ways of sorting out potential issues that might arise as the new mutuals set up. And the third thing we do, of course, is focus specifically our campaign in areas where we know there is interest, such as wider local government, including also adult social care services, children's services, youth services, and, as I said before, probation fire services.
So the Minister, Francis Maude, said back in 2011 that he wanted to see 1 million public servants working in mutuals by 2015. How close are you to achieving that aspiration?
The aspiration holds true. We have increased our number of mutuals over the last 2 years significantly. We're holding a pipeline of live and non-live or going through the system mutuals of over 100. It is a process that continues, and we are hoping to expand in more and more sectors as we go along. So the aspiration is not a target, it's an aspiration, and the aspiration covers the potential.
Rania, thank you very much for joining us on Law Talk.
Thank you.
You're listening to Law Talk, the legal news podcast from TPP Law, the public services specialist.
Now here's the latest news on developments in public service delivery.
The Pensions Bill confirms a flat rate state pension and end of contracting out. Core of the draft Pensions Bill is the reform of the state's pension system and the introduction of the single tier state pension announced in the White Paper, A Simple Foundation for Saving. The single tier state pension will replace the current basic state pension and state second pension with a flat rate payment from April 2017, with a starting level of £144, subject to future uprating. Also included are details of the increase of state pension age to age 67 between 6th of April 2026 and 5th of March 2028. The bill confirms the abolition of contracting out for salary-related pension schemes, with provisions included to protect those rights which have already been accrued.
In other news, the Ministry of Justice has published proposals for a wide-scale reform of the probation system. The Ministry of Justice published its long-awaited proposals on the 9th of January. The Justice Secretary, Chris Grayling, outlined plans for the wholesale outsourcing of probation services to private companies and voluntary sector organisations who will take over the rehabilitation of the majority of offenders by 2015. And we'll be doing a feature on that particular topic in one of our next editions.
The government has announced an incentive for local communities to draw up neighbourhood development plans by allowing them to keep 25% of the community infrastructure levy for use on local initiatives. Neighbourhoods without a neighbourhood development plan will receive a 15% share of the community infrastructure levy, capped at £100 per council tax dwelling. It is proposed that the measures will come into force in spring 2013.
On the 9th of January, the Department for Education announced in its most recent update to its publication, The Governor's Guide to the Law, that it will be replacing this guide with a concise handbook for governors in maintained schools and academies. The new handbook is expected to come out in the spring.
Monitor has published for consultation a draft of its proposed enforcement guidance. This sets out Monitor's proposed approach to exercising both its regulatory enforcement powers in the Health and Social Care Act 2012 and powers it will have as a concurrent competition regulator.
In an important ruling for data protection, in January the First Tier Tribunal upheld the Information Commissioner's decision that information concerning the number of applications that have been made to open free schools
should be disclosed by the Department for Education.
And finally, David Pryor is to be the new chair of the Care Quality Commission. David is currently chairman of the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust.
And that's all we have time for in this edition of Law Talk, but don't miss our next edition for more news on public services.
Law Talk from TPP Law, the public services specialists. Connect with us on tpplaw.co.uk or join the debate online in our LinkedIn forum. Search groups for Public Service Partnerships Forum.